This is ABC Radio 2. Eastern Time is 6:30. And now with Technology Report, here's Peter Hunt.
We're having some problems coming to grips with all the claims that are being made about AM stereo, and we haven't said very much about it.
What sort of claims?
That it's superior to FM, technically.
Isn't it?
It doesn't seem so at all. The frequency response will be a lot less than FM. The distortion, the noise, the stereo separation, all inferior to the FM band.
That was Graham Greenwood, technical advisor to radio station 2DAY, FM, speaking out there for the first time against what he claims is fraud by the promoters of AM stereo. Hello again and welcome to another Technology Report. Well, Graham Greenwood says that nearly every section of the radio industry knows that AM stereo will be in no way comparable to FM stereo, and yet he says we're constantly being told it'll be as good or better. He argues that AM stereo is little more than a marketing device or a gimmick that's going to leave a lot of customers disappointed. Also in this week's program, we're going to hear an interview that was done by Liz Fell with the Minister for Communications, Michael Duffy, about some of the difficult problems associated with the launch of the domestic satellite early next year. But first, Peter Martin has been investigating AM stereo. And we even have a test for you later in the program to rate your existing mono receiver, and we'll be hearing about a mini survey on which stereos will be on sale. AM stereo radios are to hit the stores in early November, and then there's going to be something like a 3-month advertising campaign leading up to the launch of commercial stereo in February. We'll be told that if we each part with a few hundred dollars, we'll be able to hear our favourite AM radio stations in glorious surround stereo, just like FM. But how much like FM or hi-fi is it really going to be? Well, here with the real story behind the story is the Science Unit's Peter Martin.
It's not as good. I first went to see Graham Greenwood, who's the technical advisor at Sydney station Today FM. At first he was reluctant to speak, but he gave me a set of earphones and two receivers. The receiver that tuned to AM stereo sounded muddy, sort of like talking through a hat, while the FM sounded sparkling.
We're having some problems coming to grips with all the claims that are being made about AM stereo, and we haven't said very much about it.
What sort of claims?
That it's superior to FM, technically.
Isn't it?
Well, looking at the figures that the Department of Communications have released, it doesn't seem so at all. The frequency response will be a lot less than FM. The distortion, the noise, the stereo separation, all inferior to the FM band.
But what would happen if you were to put two sets side by side?
I think it's quite clear.
No comparison?
No comparison. AM stereo is AM in stereo.
Stations like Today, in fact the FM industry generally, has been very quiet to date about the advent of AM stereo. Why haven't you spoken out?
Well, there's no need to. The customers will find the level themselves. The only thing that we really worry about with the listener is that they might go out and buy an AM stereo receiver and be completely disappointed with it, and the backlash will be on the AM operator.
You've got a vested interest in disparaging AM stereo.
We haven't in the past. You've put that to me before. We haven't. You've come to me to ask us about this, and this is how we feel. And also, I should add, from my personal point of view, that people should be careful about the AM stereo receiver they purchase to make sure that the FM stereo side of it is up to scratch. On one or two of the receivers I've heard around the place, it hasn't been so.
And on the AM stereo receiver I heard, the FM certainly did sound worse than usual. That could be to cover up the deficiencies in the AM band by bringing the FM down to its level. Or it might simply be a way to keep the cost of AM stereo sets down. Because we're broadcasting on AM at the moment, it's hard to demonstrate how the two bands compare. But you can get an indication from the standards set down by the Department of Communications. On distortion, the department restricts FM stations to just over 0.5%. But it allows AM stereo stations to go up to 4%. On signal-to-noise ratio, that's the thing which determines how loud the loud bits are and how quiet the silence is, the department specifies 60 decibels for FM, but only 48 for AM. That means the quiet passages on AM stereo are going to sound a lot quieter, even before the electrical interference for which AM is famous. On the separation between the right and left stereo channels, the department requires only half as much for AM as for FM. And finally, frequency response. The department wants 7.5 decibels for AM. That's a big improvement on what's broadcast at present, but it's still a lot less than most adults can hear. It compares with FM, which has a response of 15 decibels, well above the limit most adults can hear. I asked electrical engineer Jim Donovan to give me an idea of what the figures mean.
Jim, can you explain to me what you're going to do?
I have with me, Peter, a graphic equalizer, which I can use to take notches out of sounds. I remove the higher frequencies first. They're the parts that get cut out by your typical AM receiver. Now I've cut everything above 2 kilohertz.
I understand the normal adult hearing is about 12 kilohertz.
That's so, Peter, but the typical AM receiver is cutting severely by about 3 kilohertz and is even, 2 or 1.5 kilohertz even.
So we're now down to the level of some medium quality AM receivers.
Yes, and I can take us down even further. Now I've cut everything above 500 hertz and we're approaching telephone quality. One step further, Peter. There, now I've cut the 500s and we're getting little above possibly 350 hertz.
What you're cutting out is the high frequencies, the sparkle.
Yes, that's right, the consonants of the voices. Now I'll bring us back to full bandwidth.
There we are. Why hasn't AM stereo been broadcasting on full bandwidth for a long time?
Well, when AM started, I think 2FC in Sydney opened in 1923, there was still the wind-up gramophone with its steel needle, and there was so much distortion around that the distortion-free sound was not on.
So this cutting back on frequency, high frequencies, is a way of disguising distortion?
Yes, and if you get rid of the higher frequencies, well, there goes your distortion, mostly. Unfortunately, there goes the sparkle in the sound.
Well, what sort of level is AM stereo going to have?
AM stereo has been limited by the department to 7.5 kilohertz.
Can you show us 7.5 kilohertz?
There we are now. Once you've got 7.5 kilohertz, you are getting things like piccolos and the highest range of the organ pipes in, but you are cutting to some extent the higher harmonics of instruments like harpsichord, the violin, and also the percussion of instruments, particularly snare drums and cymbals.
Just before we do a musical test, listen to this. This is a more formal way to tell how many high frequencies your receiver can pick up.
I'll put on two tones at once. One of them is 1,000 hertz, and the other one is 5,000. And I've set these going at a level where to us in the studio, they seem to be of equal perceived volume.
They're about the same. One's very high and one's much lower. But they're about as loud as each other.
To us, they seem about as loud as each other, yes. Well, the 5,000 on most receivers would be being cut noticeably. However, it should still be audible. What I'll do now, Peter, is I'll wind the 5 kilohertz up to 10 kilohertz. And I think you'll find that many domestic receivers aren't getting any sound at all in the higher tone.
Well, I can hear a very high-pitched whistle above a low tone.
Yes.
You're saying that people at home will only be able to hear the low tone and not the high-pitched whistle at all?
When you say low tone, 1 kilohertz moderately high, but they won't be able to hear the whistle because the receiver will be cutting it out.
They would have heard it as we were winding it up and would have just heard it vanish.
Yes. Now, I'll bring its frequency back down if you like, Peter.
Okay.
There it is at 5 kilohertz, and I'll gradually bring it down to 2 kilohertz. It should now be
within the range of most home receivers.
I should think so, yes.
Well, how does that translate into music? Here's music from the ABC album, Bill Belcher's Band Bazaar.
That's full band, Peter.
We're hearing everything as it was recorded.
Yes.
I notice it's got quite a lot of cymbals, high instruments like that.
Yes. Now, I'll cut them out, Peter. I'll cut everything above about 3 kilohertz, Peter.
This is now the level that people would hear at home. And some instruments seem to be missing, or not nearly as loud.
Well, the snare drums will go. Now I'll cut everything above 1 kilohertz, Peter.
It sounds a lot less pleasant, but we can still get the sense of the music.
Yes, we can do that. In fact, now I'll cut it even more.
I'm cutting everything above about 300 hertz.
So what we have now is telephone quality.
Yes.
The thing is that you can still get the tune, but some instruments seem to be a lot softer.
Well, the snare drum will have been removed by my graphic equalizer.
So, AM, even AM stereo, is inferior. But is it really going to matter? Ron Longhams is the Managing Director of Radio Manufacturing Engineers. That's the company which is installing most of the AM stereo exciters. And I visited him at his factory in West Sydney.
I think in the environment, depending on your environment, like a car environment, or if you're listening on the beach or whatever, I think you are really not going to notice the difference unless you get down to a definite A-B comparison.
But isn't the lounge room the test?
The lounge room, I agree, would be an ultimate test, but I feel that no more than 5% of your listeners would be in the lounge room.
Where do people listen to radio?
In the kitchen, which is not a good stereo environment. In the bedroom with your clock radio, which is also not a good stereo environment. So you end up with the Walkmans, car radios, and the beach hi-fi sets, which have limited sound response anyway.
So people are more likely to notice the fact that the stations are going stereo than that they're having a wider bandwidth.
That's correct. The effects of stereo are going to be the advantage of AM stereo.
Well, not everyone agrees that stereo is the key determinant. Chris Bramall, the chairman of AM Stereo Australia, that's the consortium which is promoting stereo, says that in his view, AM stereo is hi-fi in a way Australia hasn't had before on that band.
There are numerous high-fidelity AM stereo receivers in this country at the moment that have been tested, and I have one in my lounge room, and our chief engineer has one in his lounge room, and I can assure you that it's not an inferior medium in the home situation. What you have is special benefits for AM, which FM doesn't enjoy. For instance, with AM, you don't have multipath. I mean, with AM, you really can drive in and out and around and up lanes and things in North Sydney and not get the picket fence effect.
That's stations going in and out as you move from one street to another.
Yes, that's right. And the picket fence effect, sound effects aren't my specialty.
So it's probably best to make up your mind yourself. I'd suggest listening, maybe in a car, before you buy. If you want to know what to buy, well, the choice is pretty limited. Only one company I was able to contact today has announced its plans. Pioneer intends to have a car AM-FM stereo cassette player on the market in November. That should sell for about $350. National says it's not likely to have anything till March. Philips says perhaps the end of next year. And Sharp says it's still sorting out a problem with a whistle. One final word from Chris Bramall of AM Stereo Australia. I asked him whether the technical change would improve what was actually broadcast.
I've been quoted many times as saying that simply going stereo isn't going to cause any AM station who's in trouble now to not be in trouble. If you're playing the wrong records, or you're saying the wrong things, or your announcers are unacceptable, or you tell the time wrong often enough, people won't listen to you. And if you're doing enough things wrong and you go from mono to stereo, one could even say that you're doubling your problem.
That report prepared by Peter Martin. Now to the satellite. If you're anything like me, you won't have the faintest idea what this debate's all about. At best, you might be vaguely aware that some of the most powerful interests in the country are involved. The government, the media moguls who've recently been dubbed the Kerry Murfax Group, the provincial broadcasters in our smaller cities and country towns, and of course the innumerable advertisers who lubricate the whole system with their buckets full of dollars. Well, I've been making a special effort today to actually come to terms with these incredibly complicated issues that are fast becoming a nightmare for the Labor government. My tutor for this exercise was Liz Fell, satellite sleuth extraordinaire, who was the public interest consultant on the recent satellite inquiry. Shortly, you'll be hearing an interview that Liz did with the Minister for Communications, Michael Duffy. But first, let me try and bring you up to date with the government's recurrent nightmare. As I see it, they have at least three problems. Firstly, how are they going to fulfil their promise that all Australians, wherever they live, will have access to TV soon after our first two domestic satellites are launched next year? Their next problem is how to ensure that the satellite company, Ofsat, actually makes a profit. And finally, their biggest headache is how to keep that Kerry Murfax group under control. Now, a major plank in the government's strategy is to use us, the ABC, to deliver radio and TV to some 300,000 people who are presently deprived of Brideshead Revisited, Countdown, and, of course, wonderful programs such as Technology Report. On the first two satellites, there'll be 8 high-powered transponders. The ABC is going to be using 4 of these for direct broadcast into remote area homes and communities. And in the jargon, this is termed the HACBUS 1 service. Now, for the purpose of this obviously worthwhile enterprise, Australia has been cut up into 4 different regions or zones, each with its own transponder. In practical terms, this means that the evening news will emanate from the capital city in each region. So far, so good. But the problem arises with the 4 remaining high-powered transponders, and this is where the commercial interests get into the act. Unless the government can get somebody to use up those transponders, OSSAT's going to be a commercial disaster. Now, the Kerry Murfax group are poised and ready to go, because with one of those transponders each, they could drip their advertisements, laced of course with delicacies such as Perfect Match and American Baseball, directly into every home across the nation. Well, after all, they do it now in most of the capital cities. Now, this grand scheme has been dubbed the Network Solution. So what's wrong with that? Well, in the recent satellite inquiry, the Broadcasting Tribunal identified a number of problems. Apart from the extremely high cost to country viewers who'd have to buy special receiving equipment, it could well kill off the small provincial broadcasters by starving them of advertising revenue and programs. So, the Tribunal has come up with something that they call the Regional Solution. Their proposal is to create regional consortia who then broadcast to the same 4 regions as the ABC. On the positive side, this would be much less expensive for the viewers in terms of the equipment they'd need. But then there'd only be 1 commercial service going to those remote areas, and it would almost certainly run at a loss. So who's going to buy into that kind of business proposition? Well, we'll have to wait and see, because last week, in a 17-page policy statement, the minister decided in favour of this regional solution, and then promptly handed it back to the Broadcasting Tribunal to find some far-sighted entrepreneurs. They're hoping, of course, they'll either be the provincial broadcasters or even the members of the Kerry Murfax group. Now, it's interesting because the Tribunal has recently proposed that the members of this latter group give up one of their 2 television stations. Ironically, this latest regional solution actually involves suspending the ownership limits specified in the Broadcasting and Television Act, and therefore allowing the media moguls to extend their control even further. So, does the minister's decision really stop the major networks from extending their influence using the satellite? After all, that was Kerry Packer's original idea back in 1977 when he first suggested the satellite to Malcolm Fraser. Here's Liz Fell with the present Minister for Communications, Michael Duffy.
You have 8 high-powered transponders, which is what the controversy in technical terms has been about, who's going to access those. We know that the ABC is going to access 4. Now, if the regionals aren't really ready, it's still possible for the networks to access 3 of those powerful 30-watt transponders sometime next year, isn't it?
That's correct, yes, if in fact the approach was made, say tomorrow, by the networks to OSSAT, then it's a matter for the commercial judgment of OSSAT as to who becomes the lessees of those transponders. But it would not be a licensed service to remote areas, and it would be very expensive.
Minister, some people would say that you've said yes to the regional solution, but you haven't actually said no to the network solution here, that the networks still could, even though it would be expensive for the viewer, still could deliver their television into remote areas, accessing these powerful transponders in a national beam.
They could to individuals, that is, if somebody wanted to in fact buy a dish, which on the estimates you get, they vary, and with technology changing, as you're well aware, it's not easy to pinpoint that amount, but you'd probably be looking at a figure of somewhere around $6,000. As compared to the HACPS 1 proposal, being the ABC, and what has become now known as the HACPS 2, or this proposal of remote commercial televisions. It's about 2,000. The other thing is that there would be no retransmission.
Would the network signal have to be encrypted, as you said in your earlier statement last year? Would it actually be made difficult for people to receive?
Yes, well, that's part of the cost, although it won't be a huge cost. But when we're talking about that figure of about $6,000, it would be necessary, of course, to buy a decoder.
You're likely to make another decision on encryption. I understand that you're meeting with the Broadcasting Council on Thursday. Are you likely to change your mind about whether the networks would have to be encrypted?
No, I think that you will find that there will undoubtedly be encryption. I can't see any other solution to that problem. What, however, will have to be discussed will be the question of the sophistication of the encryption.
Having talked with a couple of the networks this morning, my understanding is that at the present stage they're saying that they're not even going to apply to take the 30 watters on the satellite, which rather leaves AusSat in the lurch, doesn't it, for the second satellite. You've got the ABC on one. Who's going to use the others unless the regionals come together very, very quickly?
They're saying that again, are they?
Well, one network told me this morning that they would neither be part of a regional consortium and nor would they be interested in taking the 30 watters.
Well, that's a matter for them.
Would you be making any more announcements on this, given your meeting with the industry on Thursday? Can we expect some further statements on it?
No, I don't think that this is going to be a matter that is going to be discussed in any detail at the Broadcasting Council on Thursday. The network's proposal that they're not interested in the 30-watt transponders is one that crops up from time to time. They wax eloquent about it sometimes, and then they're not interested on other occasions. I find it very difficult to follow them from day to day, and I'm interested in your informed comment there that their latest stand is, or one of them, is that one of them is not interested in a 30-watt transponder. Well, that's news to me, but not surprising, because, as I say, it does change from time to time. But
let's assume it were the case. It rather leaves the satellite company, which is concerned about the profitability and not large losses, it rather leaves them in the lurch, doesn't it, in terms of these powerful transponders designed for broadcasting with nobody up on them?
Well, if that became the case, we might have to be looking for somebody else. I mean, we're not going to have transponders there with no one using them, I can assure you. And if the networks decide, which I don't think they will, but if they decide to take their bat and ball home and they say, well, you know, I'm not going to play in your yard.
That was Michael Duffy speaking there with Liz Fell, and incidentally one senior executive told Liz that the networks would save $12 to $16 million a year by not going up on the satellites. Production tonight, Kate Revel, Peter Shaw and Dennis Fox. I'm Peter Hunt and you've been listening to Technology Report.
ABC.